From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. It appears there may be a new area of competition at this year's Olympics in Brazil, one where the U.S. is perhaps better suited to compete than most, given its large supply of talent in the field. The new event? Litigation. The International Olympic Committee's chair, Thomas Bach, said that the ban imposed on the Russian track and field team by the International Association of Athletics Federations had his support, but he stressed that the federation should individually evaluate the cases of Russian athletes so that those not involved in doping will be able to compete in Rio in August. However, experts said it was likely that the athletes will have to go to court to make the IAAF change its ruling. Mikhail Butov, Secretary General of the Russian Athletics Federation, said that Russia will file a lawsuit against the decision to maintain Russia's ban.
Of course, first of all, we were very disappointed of the decision of last Friday from the IAAF Council. And main disappointing concern, first of all, of course, our athletes. What we can do now? Now we can firstly try to appeal to this decision. At that moment, we cannot tell you exactly how, because we are now in the permanent contact with lawyers, with different lawyers. Secondly, of course, we will think about the new status of neutral athletes. This status was involved in the IAAF rules. It just was done last Friday, and we checked absolutely of this possibility and sent already a request to IAAF to explain what it means.
After claiming responsibility for infiltrating the Democratic National Committee's database, a hacker or group of hackers using the name Guccifer 2.0 published alleged research allegedly compiled by the DNC on strategies to protect presidential candidate Hillary Clinton from political attacks. Guccifer 2.0 released Tuesday a document titled Dossier on Hillary Clinton from DNC, described as coming from a folder of documents devoted to Clinton allegedly found on the DNC server. In announcing the hack of the DNC last week, Guccifer 2.0 leaked documents detailing the DNC's strategy to use mainstream news media to attack Clinton's Republican opponents, among other revelations. The strategy would refute Republican attacks that claimed Secretary of State Clinton from 2009 to 2013 rushed into military conflict in Libya and abandoned the country after the fall of Muammar Gaddafi, leading to the rise of the Islamic State. The document release also included details of large donors to the Clinton Foundation. The foundation has been challenged over its role in Haiti in the aftermath of the 2010 earthquake and elsewhere. And it's not just the hand of the Clinton Foundation that may be stuck in the cookie jar in Haiti. A new report claims that the American Red Cross mismanaged funds meant to rebuild Haiti after the devastating 2010 earthquake. RT America's Anya Parampil has more.
A new report has slammed the American Red Cross for mismanaging its donations and funds, which were meant to aid Haiti after the devastating 2010 earthquake. The report released by Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley's office found the charity spent about a quarter of donations made in wake of the disaster, about $125 million, on its own internal expenses. It also found the Red Cross routinely hindered Congress's ability to get information about its program in Haiti and make it public. Discoveries include that while the Red Cross claimed to have spent $70 million on, quote, program expenses in Haiti, it could provide no evidence of it. That the charity's CEO, Gail McGovern, claimed it had provided all necessary information to the Government Accountability Office during a previous interview with Grassley's office, but had indeed failed to turn over information requested. It also found the group's own internal unit tasked with investigating wrongdoing and abuse is extremely understaffed and underfunded.
April's presidential primary in New York saw more than 100,000 Democratic voters finding themselves disenfranchised as they found they had been purged from voter rolls, with Brooklyn being ground zero of the apparent voter purge. On Tuesday, radio station WNYC reported that it had conducted a study that found out of more than the 120,000 voters taken off the rolls in New York City, the purge disproportionately impacted Hispanic voters. That, according to an analysis done by the station of the names of voters who were removed. The station Tuesday released its analysis, finding that 15.2% of people with typical Hispanic surnames were taken off the Brooklyn voter rolls, compared with 9.5% of everyone else. When WNYC mapped the voters' addresses, they found the purged voters were more likely to be in Hispanic-majority election districts. The analysis found that 13.9% of voters in Hispanic-majority districts were removed, compared with 8.7% of voters in other districts. A boxing match at the White House? It appeared that the State Department and President Barack Obama were at major odds over policy in Syria as news came out of a so-called dissent channel letter inside the State Department signed by many of the staffers there, accusing the president of being soft on Syria. President Obama reportedly stood in that challenge, but that's not the case with a certain expert who first challenged a fellow expert to a debate and then, apparently, chickened out. The one who showed up was Mark Sloboda. He showed up at the latest edition of RT's Crosstalk, hosted by Peter Laveau, to discuss this letter. We spoke with Mark via Skype from Moscow Wednesday. I understand that someone challenged you to a duel and then didn't show up at noon.
Yeah. So I regularly engage on the battlefields of the information war, Twitter is one of the most prolific of these battlefields in the current day. I think I myself was a slow adopter of Twitter. I find the 144 character limit to be, you know, reducing everything to propaganda buzzwords talking point,
To 144 characters.
Yeah. So it's extremely reductionist. But other than its use as a propaganda tool, and unfortunately you do have to engage in that these days, the other use of it is to follow all of the Western journalists, think tankers, academics, so on, and what they do on Twitter, the amount of groupthink as they associate with each other, the things they say and comment in between the articles that they officially write, where you can get a real sense of their, complete lack of objectivity, their
hatred of Russia, China,
and other, you know, non-Western countries and so on.
Yeah, you notice that they don't have a problem fitting all of their thoughts from the think tank into 144 characters, by the way.
Yeah. Another thing that's really noticeable is that while I and another of other people I associate with dutifully follow all of these, and we're talking hundreds of them, you know, on different fields and so on, they don't follow people who disagree with them back. They exist in a bubble of Western media narrative. Well, so at least a few people like me who, engage in this information war, we are fully aware of what our side of the issues say and what their side of the issues say. And, you know, we don't hesitate to engage on those lines. But I think it was about last Friday when a fellow military vet from the United States, Michael Pregent, who was supposedly the intelligence advisor to David Petraeus, the U.S. Military general who was the architect of the so-called war on terror, was then director of the CIA, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, then he was director of the CIA, and most recently, after getting fired or admonished for revealing top secret information to a journalist that he was sleeping with, he has since reinvented himself. He was lobbying Congress that the United States should ally with al-Qaeda in Syria. And, you know, those are pretty much the headline. He said moderate elements of al-Qaeda. Which, that says it all right there. Anyway, with this, Michael Pregent was supposedly his intelligence advisor. More recently, he got attention and drawn into the spheres of the U.S. commentariat because he started up a group, which as far as I can tell consists entirely of himself, called Vets Against the Deal, and they're speaking against the Iran deal. So because of this, he was picked up as a commentator, particularly by Fox News, and he has become a regular on Fox and Friends, and Newsmax. Occasionally now appearing a few times on CNN as well. The man is not unintelligent. I won't say that. But engaged with him online, and he off the cuff challenged me. He said he'd be willing to debate me on Syria anytime if I was ever in D.C. And my reply to that was, we live in the modern age.
Right, that's right.
I don't need to be in D.C. I said, give the word, and I can arrange that debate, in the next 2 weeks. Oh, and he said, excellent. I look forward to it, right? So I gave the producers that I know at Crosstalk at RT a call and said, hey, are you interested in this? And of course they were, and they arranged it over the weekend, and I went on Tuesday afternoon, heading into the studio for what I thought was a throwdown debate, not only against him, but there was a third participant who was – and he actually showed up. This is Lawrence Wilkerson, which is Colin Powell's old chief of staff when he was Secretary of State.
Right. You're swimming with the big boys.
Yeah, and also a – he's also a retired colonel himself.
Right.
Pregent backed out of the debate at the last minute. The wonderful producers at Crosstalk at RT did manage to find a sub replacement. Also from the Hudson Institute,
right? Richard Pregent. Weiss, yeah.
He, give him credit, shows up to debate with people who disagree with him,
right.
Unlike Pregent. Pregent handed a terse email to the producers at RT saying he had competing obligations that suddenly appeared. But online, when I got home and called him out for being a piece of shall we say chicken feces who chickened out, he said he didn't even bother with that pretense of a justification and just said that, well, let's do it in a more reputable venue. I forgot, a more reputable venue won't have you.
Uh-huh.
And to which my response was, a more reputable venue, what you mean, like the Koch brothers funded Fox and Friends and Newsmax, the choir at there. And I said, I've interviewed and been debated on BBC, France 24, right. Al Jazeera, TRT World, CCTV, Dutch TV, Press TV, you name it, other than, of course, U.S. media, which other than yourself is not very fond of such dissenting views.
I don't get in there much either, by the way.
Yeah. And, I really wondered at this. I took this a little bit further, because if he had showed up, and I was actually excited about this, this would have been three U.S. military vets, one of them intelligence, another one in the Army, and myself in the Navy nuclear engineering, appearing on Russian-funded propaganda, Russian state TV, RT, to discuss in a heated what would have been a heated debate on three opposing positions. Lawrence Wilkerson takes a more moderate, middle of the road position. Pregent and neocon, obviously, and myself, geopolitically approximating to a leftist, I guess you could say, a pro-Russian point of view.
A pro-multilateral point of view.
Yeah. This is three U.S. military vets appearing on Syria, which is a current proxy war, a very heated proxy war, bordering on hot war between the U.S. and Russia, on Russian state TV. Right. Now, to point to you how astounding that should be to everyone who listens.
Yeah.
Imagine three, you know, hell would freeze over before you would see three Russian military vets arguing the same issue on American TV.
Oh, please, or three American vets for that matter, because they all have the same line.
And, if they tow the correct range of narrative,
the narrative, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me just say one thing here, because, you know, we heard a little bit of the resumes of the other two. But yourself, as you said, you're a naval veteran. You lecture in international affairs at Moscow State University. I mean, that all by itself is pretty remarkable.
And security stuff. And my postgraduate is from the London School of Economics.
Okay.
I've also organized previously in a previous political incarnation for the Democratic Party. I headed up Democrats Abroad in Russia, worked with the U.S. Embassy registering voters for elections, both here and in London when I was there studying. So I have a range of military, political, and academic experience.
I think so, yeah.
So yeah, it would have been an interesting debate between the three of us. And my point is that RT, in particular Crosstalk, which I'm a regular contributor to, they regularly have and invite on people, neocons, the very worst of the pro American hegemony. Argument. They're regularly invited on. A lot of there's a campaign not to appear on RT. Some of them still come on. But the point is they're invited. They do some of them occasionally do come on and engage. But when was the last time you heard someone with a Russian with a pro-Russian position or someone from China with a pro-Chinese position appear on any political debate or interview in the United States?
Never. Only here. One of the things that I do here is when Putin or Xi or Assad or any of them come out and speak on a particular issue that's at the center of the news at that point in time, I play what they said in their words with their translation track. And it's the only time, unless people hunt for this on the internet, that people hear it in the media.
No, it is. And that should really be astounding to people, what they think. I mean, people... The propaganda tells us that Russia doesn't have any independent voices. The media is all controlled by the government. The only thing I can say is anyone who says that does not speak Russian, because there is more range of heated debate about the president's, the government, what's going on in Syria, Ukraine, far more wide ranging, far more nuanced debate. In the newspapers, in Russia are downright anti-Putin, the majority of them. They take a very hard line against the president and the Kremlin. But they also appear on the political channels, even on the state, what are the state-owned media channels.
Right.
They regularly invite them on. And I believe this is how the Russian government tries to inoculate the public to the propaganda coming out of the West, not by banning it or blocking it or never inviting it onto your channels, but by bringing them on, bringing Americans, pro-American Americans, and not just me, and other people like me, but Ukrainians and so on into real political debate, and saying this is what they're saying, right?
I would say it's the fourth time this past weekend that I was on First Channel in Russia, which is the largest network there, talking about the American election. I mean, they have Americans on frequently. They had a Russian translation track over me speaking.
Yes, I've been a regular on First Channel and many other channels myself. Yeah. The Russian TV. In this respect, or at least when it comes to someone like me or you, who do have views that geopolitically at least approximate their own, they do the exact same thing now that the U.S. did during the Cold War and continues to do, never stopped, with outlets, state propaganda outlets like Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, etc., they give a voice to fringe opposition figures, like in the U.S., that would be me and yourself, that would never have a platform to speak otherwise on their own media, and provide it for them to speak against the other government. This is why we had to see the Green Party and the Libertarian Party in the U.S. national debates to elect their presidential candidates on Russian Today.
That's right.
Because they couldn't get a decent, you know, primetime coverage on a major channel in the United States.
Right.
And this is exactly what Western media continues to do, not just Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, but also the regular media. I'm talking the New York Times, you know, CNN, the Big Three, the New Yorker, the Guardian, the, you know, Washington Post, what have you. They are very careful to select when they do speak to Russians, Russians who are, you know, pet creatures of American gongos and think tanks and so on, who have pro-American points of view.
Right.
These are marginal figures in Russian politics and society.
Right. Right.
But they're given the same platform. And there are RT and Sputnik and, you know, and others, you know, even the head national Russian language channels like First Channel and so on are doing the same thing. They're just doing it better and more cutting edge these days, and their ratings, you know, online, you know, in particular, I'm thinking of RT, which has the most YouTube hits of any news channel, by far
in English language.
In the English language, so this is the information game we're playing.
There's an example of this in the dissent letter, so-called, where the media is covering that here. Like it's almost the coordination with the Clinton campaign to force the issue.
Absolutely, absolutely. I agree completely with that reading of it. What we're talking about is there was a letter signed by – a dissent letter signed by 51 U.S. diplomats and other employees in the State Department that are chafing under Obama's – what they present as non-willingness to intervene in Syria. And this is done through an established mechanism in the State Department, a dissent channel, which theoretically is a very good thing, which allows people to openly disagree with present policy. It's been in place for a long time. What's unusual about this, one, is that it was actually made public, and it was very clearly intentionally made public, which is not the way these things happens. And two, that so many diplomats signed this. And it seems to have the open support of the former U.S. ambassador to Syria, Robert Ford, who was directly involved in inciting the conflict in its initial protest stages on the ground in Syria, that, you know, playing the role of a I don't want to call him an infiltrator and saboteur rather than what he should have been doing.
Vicky Newland,
the role
with,
of a diplomat.
Cookies.
Yeah, he's the Syrian Newland before Newland, just a little less well known. And he later left the administration protesting against Obama's unwillingness to bomb Syria. John Kerry seems to have tacitly supported this as well, and it's well known that he has also disagreed with Obama as Obama's own Secretary of State about the Syria policy. And this is presented on one hand as if Obama has done nothing or Obama has tried, you know, to limit U.S. engagement. Obama has been waging a not-so-convert proxy war, well reported in the pages of the Washington Post and the New York Times, for the last 6 years. You know, funding, arming, training, and paying the salaries, all illegal, of proxy fighters for the express purpose of overthrowing the Syrian government.
That's right.
We have from released DIA cables obtained from the Information Awareness Act that the U.S. was perfectly aware that its interference interference in Syria would lead to the rise of an Islamic caliphate in eastern Syria and west Iraq, that the U.S.'s allies in the region and itself, we're talking Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, regarded this as a strategic asset. Essentially, because it could be used as President Putin has said, as a battering ram to knock down the Syrian government, and then dealt with in some undisclosed manner later. Basically, exactly what happened in Libya, and we all see the results of what happened in Libya. You know, and of course the prior U.S. Invasion and occupation of Iraq that turned out so well.
Now, the distinction, you know, between this one and those being the veto by Russia and China several times at the UN Security Council over attempts to impose a no-fly zone, quote unquote, which means to conduct an air war against Syria.
Yes, and I believe that even without UN Security Council approval, one of the most important compelling reasons why Russia decided to intervene with the permission of the Syrian government, legally that is, last September, was because the United States and Turkey, you know, of course with Saudi backing, were about to begin a Libya-style operation with the establishment of no-fly zones over northern Syria along the Turkish border, which would be used to build up, you know, their proxy forces free of any attacks, and would, of course, would also entail an air campaign against Syria to suppress air defense, take out command and control, the whole slippery slope 9 yards that we saw in Libya when a no-fly zone becomes a the rest of the country becomes a bombing zone.
for nine months. Yeah. And, you know, Cynthia McKinney spoke with me on the ground in Tripoli one day in June of 2011. And she had been sitting with people from the African Union who were there to observe. And they counted 18 bombs over the course of 11 hours just in Tripoli. And that went on from March until November.
Yeah, that is the standard. That we use the euphemism of safe zone or no fly zones. You know, but military terms, what in that entails is a you know, blanket bombing campaign over these countries that, you know, very swiftly escalates into providing then close air support when you know, these proxies still are unable to take territory on the ground. And it was only after close air support and the bringing in of thousands of Qataris that the U.S. was able to flip, you know, what Tripoli, you know, in their favor. And but not that it has turned out well for them afterwards, as they're still hemming and hawing, putting their feet in the water about a second military intervention in Libya now. That the results of the first one destroyed the country and turned it into a warlord and ISIS and other Islamists ruled the hellhole, essentially.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because what happened, essentially, the first strike by al-Qaeda against the United States was a stolen commercial aircraft, and now they have the U.S. Air Force. Amazing.
Yeah, this... And, you know, like we open this up with, this is what such figures as General Petraeus, the architect of the war on terror, have actually argued for, right? The U.S. has been completely cynical about al-Qaeda in Syria. It's known as Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS. They want to manage these and prune them. I don't believe in some conspiracy theory that they're secretly running them like puppets, but they knew the likely consequences of their actions. And they were perfectly willing to use those consequences, putting weapons in the hands of anyone, if that would further their geopolitical goals. And, you know, we saw a similar situation in Ukraine. We saw it in Afghanistan with the arming of the Mujahideen in the late 70s and throughout the 80s. This is, you know, a repeat pattern of behavior of the willingness to use extremists and being very sanguine about how this would then be cleaned up later, you know, when, you know, they try to put their, you know, Washington-trained government in exiles install in these places then after this very messy regime change. Yeah. Now, what should astound everyone about this dissent letter, you know, other than the fact it was made public, is the Orwellian nature of this. These are U.S. diplomats, the people who are supposed to be bringing fighting for peace.
Right.
arguing for a complete violation of the UN Charter and international law.
Right.
Right. No Security Council mechanism or anything, just U.S. unitarily and acting militarily in the world. And they're arguing for an aggressive war on another country, the only goals of which they explicitly say is for leverage.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.